Okay, everybody, come back. Come back. Wherever you are. So in the full Cultivating Emotional Balance, we do lots of practice because we have 42 hours. We haven't really done that much except set our motivation because I really wanted to spend time on the emotions, the function of emotions, and the timeline. Whenever I have just a day long, I feel like those are the pieces that you can take away that are especially helpful. But I did want to introduce you to this one meditation technique that I've just found super helpful in my own practice. And a lot of people have given feedback that of all the practices in the Cultivating Emotional Balance, this is one that's very, very helpful. Very simple to learn, very simple to do. Kind of a one-size-fits-all practice for the emotions, since we won't really have time to talk about all the different emotions. We're going to try and talk about anger a little bit before the end of the day, but this one sort of applies to everything. And it's especially for, now that you've been introduced to the timeline, it's a way of kind of working with our emotional awareness and with our emotional transformation. So it'll sort of make even more sense now that you've been introduced to all the elements in the timeline. This meditation technique is called RAIN. It's an acronym that's very easy to remember, and it was developed by a Vipassana teacher called Michelle McDonald. It's being used a lot by, there's another meditation teacher some of you might have heard of called Tara Brach. Also, I heard recently that one of Jack Kornfield's books has this RAIN meditation technique in it. And so it's a technique especially for working with kind of our emotional triggers when we feel really stuck in an emotional experience and bringing more awareness to it. And the first step of RAIN is recognizing what is happening. So one of the ways that we can recognize what's happening, and sometimes the first kind of key to the fact that we are becoming emotional, is the physiological changes in our body. So feeling the sensations in our body, kind of feeling what's happening, recognizing what's going on. If it's helpful, we can name the emotion that we become aware of experiencing. And then the second step, allowing life to be just as it is. So allowing that emotional experience. This is something that I've worked with a lot as a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner. Often we're encouraged, quick, apply the antidote to the disturbing emotion without wasting any time at all. And I found in my own experience, just allowing myself to feel the emotion was very, very helpful. And sometimes it just, the emotion just kind of unraveled itself if I just gave it space and allowed. I often find with my emotional experience, the more I resist it, the more I exaggerate it, and the more prolonged the emotional experience is. Because then not only you're feeling emotional, but then you're sort of panicking about feeling emotional. And then you're sort of feeling bad about the panic you feel about being emotional. And then you're upset about yourself for panicking about the experience. And then it just becomes this mess that's almost impossible to unravel. And I found for myself, just sitting, anchoring myself with the breath, allowing myself to feel what I'm feeling. And this gave me the insight, especially into anger, that it's often a secondary emotion, and what's more basic is an underlying feeling of some kind of vulnerability. Because I remember one time, I don't feel anger much, but I remember one time, I was having a conversation with a friend, and all of a sudden, it was so intense. We were sitting having lunch, and I just felt this like, whoom, like this intense thing, like just kind of come up in my body. And I remember just going, wow, this is sort of different. I don't usually feel such powerful anger. Being a good, well-trained Buddhist nun, I got up from the table, did a 180, and walked away. And my friend is like, you know, I walked away because I realized how intense it was, and I was going to do something destructive, potentially, or say or do something So by the way, this is a completely accepted Buddhist technique. When you're feeling like perhaps you might engage in destructive emotional behavior, just leave. Just get out of the situation. It's weird, but it's better than yelling and having a fight, you know. So anyway, I went to my room, and I was living in a Buddhist center at that time, and I sat on the cushion. I just anchored myself with my breath and felt these, you know, in my body. And almost immediately as I anchored with the breath, it's like, oh, wow, he really hurt my feelings with that thing that he said. And I realized I was able to kind of drop below the anger and realize, oh, it's really hurt feelings is what I'm really feeling. I mean, before that, you know, I was in this reactive mode. I was right in the middle of the refractory period. I'm like, I'm going to move, you know, maybe leave the state, maybe change my religion. You know, I was like going to this extreme. You know, by the way, this person lived next door to me at the Buddhist center, so I was like, how do I never see him again? Well, I have to move because he lives next door. Okay, well, I'll move, and where will I go? I'll pack up my car this afternoon. You know, your mind just spins out on this thing. But the minute I realized it was hurt feelings, then the anger just dissolved because I was like, wow, he really hurt my feelings. It's somebody I really care about, and wow. So I sat there for a while until kind of allowing that emotional experience. And then I realized, oh, I can talk to him. I mean, I went from avoidance, I never want to see him again and I have to move this afternoon, to, wow, I just need to let him know, you know, that he really hurt my feelings. So I went and knocked on his door and he opened it and he was a little bit like, you know. And he was like, wow, I knew you were really upset. I had no idea why. And so I said, well, when you said that thing that you said, and I kind of quoted back to him what he said, and he was like, that's not what I meant at all. And we had this great conversation and actually got even closer, because then there was this trust of like, we can talk about difficult stuff, you know? And for my whole life, I had been sort of a black belt people pleaser, like, and very conflict avoidant. Did not want to talk about difficult stuff. Let's just pretend it's all okay. So as part of my learning curve of like, well, you have a conflict with someone. Yeah, you can talk about it and it can be okay. So for me, sometimes just the R and the A is enough. You know, just kind of allowing the emotional experience can be enough for the thing to unravel, or you get the insight, and then you can just kind of work it out yourself. The next step, though, we can go to the next step, investigate the inner experience with a caring presence. And this is where we can start to look a little bit at that emotional alert database. Start to see, is there some underlying storyline going on here? Like, I'm never good enough, I'm always going to fail, people don't like me. And the important part, and I think Tara Brach really emphasizes this, is with kindness, with a caring presence. Because when we start to investigate some of that stuff, it's easy to just go, oh, my stuff. Oh, I got this stuff. You know, and actually be hard on ourselves for those things, especially the learned kind of things from childhood or whatever. So it's really about having a caring, loving presence and kindness with ourselves with the investigation. And one of the things that some of the teachers really, and also the Kristen Neff, who teaches self-compassion, and at this point of the process, they suggest you can even kind of put your hand on your heart to just symbolize this caring presence. You know, one of my students in Canada were experimenting with different ways, like going through kind of difficult stuff in meditation. Sometimes it's helpful. One of my friends in Canada, she said she would just sort of cup her hands around her face. Just this sort of tender gesture of like, I'm with you. You're saying to yourself, like, you know, yeah, this is hard. This stuff is kind of owie, looking at all of our emotional alert database, you know, and because a lot of it does come from, you know, hurts we've experienced. Like I said, it's an open system. It's not necessarily childhood, but sometimes just doing something to symbolize this caring presence and to be very gentle and kind with ourselves. And then the last step is non-identification, and this is really important too. So often when we're really caught up in emotional experience, it's easy to very much identify. I mean, even our language. In English, I am angry. I am sad. A lot of other languages, it's like, I have anger, I have sadness. Somebody was telling me in Chinese, I was asking another student in Chinese, it's like, more like I am experiencing the emotion. But when you use the verb to be, like we do in English, wow, pretty solid identification. So one of the things that we can do in this step of the meditation is just kind of open to that spacious awareness within which the different thoughts are arising, within which the emotions and feelings are arising. Just kind of open to that spaciousness, because it's easy to get very solidified and stuck and kind of concretized in our emotional experience. So I want to guide you through this practice, so we'll get a little bit of experience with this. And the first step of this meditation is actually thinking of a time recently when you felt a triggering emotion, and it's important to think of something that's not going to be too overwhelming. And that's kind of like saying, don't think about a pink elephant, because of course that's where your mind goes. But we don't want people to just be a mess in here. So trying to think of maybe a recent emotional episode, but not something that's triggering of a hugely strong emotion. If it's anger, think of something that's more along the lines of annoyance or irritation or sadness, you know, not overwhelming grief, something like that, right? But especially a trigger that you want to bring a little bit more attention to. So I'll guide you through this meditation. So we'll first sit in our meditation posture with our back straight. Just sit comfortably. There's a very kind of classic meditation posture, but for now, just kind of make sure that you're comfortable but alert. So relaxed and alert at the same time. These two qualities are not contradictory. We can be experiencing them simultaneously. And then since we've been sitting pretty much all day long, let's just take a minute to do a body sweep, starting at the crown of the head. And sweep your awareness down through your body, checking for any tightness or tension or constriction in your body, and deliberately relaxing. So pay attention to the sensations in your forehead and around your eyes. We often kind of unconsciously hold some tension and tightness there. And then relaxing through your face and jaw. So we should be as much as possible with our mouth closed, breathing through our nose, but with our jaw not clenched or tight, but relaxed. And then the neck and shoulders. Bring your awareness there. Another place we often hold a lot of tension and tightness in the neck and in the shoulders. And then relax the arms all the way down to the hands. So bringing your awareness down your biceps, forearms, hands. Just checking if there's any tightness or tension. And then back to the torso. Lift the chest, open up the sternum, get that nice upright posture, but your body relaxed around it. And then sweep down the torso. And relax the belly. Relax the buttocks. And then sweep down the legs all the way down to the feet. And then after relaxing the body completely, spend a few moments focusing on the sensations of the breath in the body, either at the abdomen with your diaphragm expanding and contracting, or at the level of your chest with your lungs expanding and contracting. Or your nostrils, the sensation of the air going in and out of your nostrils or up in your nose as you inhale. So spending a few moments just focusing on these sensations when you notice your mind wandering away, just gently release any distraction and return to the sensations of the breath. And now, in the mind, recall an emotional trigger that you'd like to bring more attention to, something that's left you with a regrettable feeling and that perhaps distances you from others after the emotion has passed. So try not to pick something too traumatic. And as you're thinking of an emotional trigger, bring to mind a specific instance where this emotional trigger made you feel contracted and stuck in an emotional experience. And through your imagination, begin to picture or feel yourself in this situation. If it involved another person, picture their face, their voice, or their behavior that triggered you, And if you're by yourself, bring to mind your thoughts and behaviors that triggered you, and hold this episode in mind until you feel yourself getting re-triggered, a little bit re-triggered. So drawing from your memory as a way of re-triggering just slightly that emotion. And as you feel yourself getting re-triggered, as you draw from memory, from that emotional episode, recognize, become aware of the emotional experience, and recognize what's happening right now. And if it's helpful, you can name the emotion that's present. And as you're recognizing the emotion that's present, just keep the intention to allow the emotional experience to be here, to be what it is. And now with the caring presence, begin to gently investigate. Investigate if there's any underlying belief associated with the emotion. Maybe there's an idea of not being able to trust others, or that others are out to get me, or that I'm not good enough, I'm going to fail. And don't try and think your way through this too analytically. Just wait and see if anything comes up. And here's where you can symbolize this caring presence, if it feels comfortable, by putting your hand at your heart, just to symbolize a heartfelt concern of kindness towards yourself during this investigation. And if you notice some underlying beliefs, investigate if there's any corresponding sensations in your body. And continue noticing these thoughts and sensations from within this quiet space of awareness without being stuck inside them. Notice how the experiences naturally arise and pass. And then drop any analysis, drop any concepts, and just return for a moment to the sensations of the breath. So any questions or comments or experiences about that practice? It's really easy, but can be very powerful. It's just a way to sort of implement a little bit more awareness into the emotional episodes. Yeah. Anything come up? Or anything come up that you feel brave enough to share? That's a different question, isn't it? Yeah. Because sometimes with the investigation, we can get really caught up in the story and it can become a little bit more solid, right? Like if we notice something, that there is something there, that there is a really strong belief, sometimes there then can be a tendency of just like, oh my God, like this is who I am. And it's just like so concrete. So kind of doing that at the end, because there can't, I mean, not necessarily, and it sounds like you were doing it in a very spacious way, some of the information was coming up, but especially the more we investigate, especially getting back to some of the like deeply kind of triggering things, sometimes that's where we can kind of like really solidify. So then breathing that space and just going, you know, it's just an experience I'm having. Watch the feelings come and go, the sensations come and go, the thoughts associated with a come and go, so kind of getting a little bit more space there. And I think that's why it's done after the investigation step, because we can get tripped up a little bit there, which is why I think it's Tara Brach. And by the way, if you Google this RAIN practice, there's a lot of nice articles online by some of these teachers. And I remember reading one by Tara Brach, and she just says, you know, investigating with kindness and then really having that sort of spaciousness after the fact, because that's where we can get tripped up. We see something and then we just feel hopeless, like, oh my God, this is my stuff. It's just so monolithic. So I think that step at the end can be helpful. And it may not always happen, but just kind of non-identifying with it and just going, it's just a story. I can sort of reframe the story. I can let go of it. It's not really who I am. Yeah, good question. Yeah. Any other comments? Okay. Well, I'm trying to figure out. I don't want to overwhelm you, and it's probably already too late for that aspiration to be fulfilled. I think what we might do is just a little bit about working with hot triggers and maybe kind of wrap it up with that, because again, this has just been a lot of stuff. So let's do that rather than going into a whole new thing about anger. Yes.
Going backwards again.
Yeah, no, it's all right.
To this part of non-identification, because one of my big triggers, which isn't there now, although it still comes up, but it's not a trigger for anything, was not being good enough. And the basic idea from childhood was to really make people happy.
Yeah.
In particular.
Yeah.
And to have it last.
Not yeah.
To be coming and going. It was like, you know, or to make a roommate happy or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And so in a sense, it's like I realized in retreat about, you know, the truth is, in order for me to actually feel like I could accomplish what my aim was only by being enlightened. And interimly, I could do my best.
Right.
But the truth is,
Yeah.
This is a part of, you know, this samsaric, ugly mind, and it just is the way it is.
Yeah.
Do it for someone else.
Yeah, that's right.
Rather than non-identification, I've kind of identified with that in a wholesome, Well, yeah, it's true, and that's okay, because that's, you know, and it's kind of a motivator. Turn it like that, but it's not like I'm identifying this is me.
Right. And, you know, I would say, like, for me, for sure, I can completely relate to what you're saying. And for me, there's so much in Buddhism that adds to that investigation piece. Like, I am a complete survivor of the perfectionist low self-esteem continuum, because it's really the same thing of like, oh, I'm not perfect, therefore I'm worthless, with no middle ground at all, right? Which, like, can anybody relate to what I'm saying here? Oh, yeah, show of hands. So I think, you know, to me, and that was one of the great gifts of Buddhism is, well, duh. Like, of course I'm not perfect because I'm not enlightened yet and I'm a mixed bag, and part of the nature of samsara is to have mental afflictions and ignorance. So what do I expect? And talking to myself like that, but it's a huge relief of like, yeah, I'm a mixed bag. So that's become kind of more of my story, which has defused a lot of the I'm not good enough, because it's like, you know, and I find it helpful somehow to talk to myself as if I were, you know, like somebody's aunt from Brooklyn or something. So what did you expect? You think you're an arhat yet? Like, come on. You know, just this way of defusing that ridiculous perfectionism that just goes, oh, I disappointed someone. It's the end of the world. Let me slip my wrist. And it's just like, duh, like, hi, guess what? You're an unenlightened being. What on earth did you expect? So I think there's a lot of stuff from Buddhism that I think is sort of ammunition for defusing those parts of the emotional alert database, which is like, if I'm not perfect, I'm worthless, and I'm expected to be perfect and please everybody all the time and never make a mistake and never leave my shoes on when I go into the, you know, it's like such a story, isn't it? If I'm always going to just be omniscient and know exactly how to behave in every situation and please everybody in the situation. And it's such a great relief to accept ourselves as a flawed work in progress. I mean, to me, that was one of the greatest gifts of Buddhism. It's like, oh, I can just relax. And then also, the flip side of that is giving ourselves credit for, like, working on ourselves, because I don't think we give ourselves nearly enough credit. I mean, you guys have been sitting here all day long, man. Give yourself, like, some serious pats on the back that you've been doing this very hard work, showing a lot of vulnerability, really looking at your mind, because that's another missing link, I think, for us often is, you know, for me, I'm always comparing myself to Lama Zopa and His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Of course, always coming up short. And I find it much more useful to compare myself to myself, you know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 6 years ago. Then I feel really inspired of like, oh, yeah, I really am changing. You know, and His Holiness says that. He says, when you feel discouraged, think about, you know, how you used to be. You should be finding yourself more patient, more kind, more tolerant. And that means your practice is working. Because I think sometimes we set the bar just astronomically and ridiculously high. And then, of course, we always feel like a failure. So, yeah, I think a lot of the storyline can really change. And then there's a whole realm, you know, and it's funny what I did during the teacher training in Mexico. We had a 5-week teacher training on this. And then we had to do a project at the end. And what I did for my project, I really wanted to apply our Lam Rim meditations. For those of you that are Buddhist students, how do our Lam Rim Buddhist meditations attenuate the emotional episode timeline? So that was my final project, because I thought, well, there's this whole other realm. Like Alan Wallace teaches a lot of mindfulness practices and four immeasurables, but then we have all of the meditations on impermanence and emptiness and bodhicitta and all of this other stuff. So I did this whole project to show how that fit in. So I think that's even just more kind of ammunition for attenuating our emotional reactions. But thanks for bringing that up, because for the people who are Buddhist students in the room, you can think like that too. In the investigation piece, add kind of your Buddhist understanding of things in there too. Things are impermanent. They're empty of inherent existence. They're a projection of my mind. They're dependent arising. All of those perspectives we can add into the investigation too. Yeah, good, yeah, good.
It's a little bit different tilt on what you said.
And yeah.
I thought first I wouldn't even say anything, but then I thought, well.
No, I think it's good.
It is, you know, it's almost like it's not necessarily non-identification.
Yeah.
But it's like, it is like this relief and weight.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And when it comes up, you can say, oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Just based on where I am right now.
Yeah,
but
yeah. Exactly. That's right. Like, we exist as a process, because it's so easy to solidify a lot. And so getting used to how, you know, the fact that we exist as a process, not as something concrete, as we'd say in Buddhist terms, inherently existent, you know, self-existent. And that's another insight that we can apply. So, yeah, thank you for saying that, because I think it is a whole other piece that we can bring in when we have that training as well. Yeah, good. All right, we'll look at just a couple more things, because I can tell you guys are like, you know, which is understandable. Let's see. Whoops. Let's go back one. So applying awareness to our emotional episode timeline, we're going to look at some things. So working with our emotional behaviors when we're feeling emotional and ready to act. So this is one of the techniques that we can do. Remember, we had in that point of the emotional episode timeline, we had the automatic reaction and then the more mindful response. So just asking ourselves, is what I'm about to say or do helpful to me, helpful to other people, helpful to the world, kind of helpful globally. So really asking those questions in that moment when you're kind of getting ready to act. And this is what can help shift from that automatic reaction to a more mindful response, keeping some of these things in mind. By the way, people have been, I should have said this at the beginning of the day, do you have an email list of everybody who's registered for the class?
If they registered online, yes.
Okay, if you registered online, because I was thinking if anybody would like, I can send you a PDF of the slides so you have these notes. And I'm sorry, I should have said that in the very beginning of the day, but it's good that you've been taking notes. But what I can do is send Urs a PDF of this, and he can distribute it to everyone so that you can have some of the extra notes. Did you
have? Do you have also a PDF of your the final work you did for the teacher's
training? Yeah, I can send that to you too. Yeah, because that was kind of interesting to look at that too.
Yeah, I couldn't hear.
A PDF of that LAMRIM, applying the LAMRIM to that. Yeah. Yeah. And then sometimes the most constructive thing that we can do is take a break. Remember I said completely valid Buddhist technique and completely valid cultivating emotional balance technique is to take a break. There's some guidelines for what we call a wise break. So especially in close relationships, don't just disappear and check into the Motel 6 for a week without telling your partner. Even I know that. So telling the other person that you'd like to take a wise break in order to avoid being hurtful, right? So this can be very helpful to just say, you know, I need a time out so that I won't say or do anything. It's good to communicate, too, with your people that you're in close relationships, that you're trying to do this work, that you're working on this, you know, ahead of time. So it's not necessarily in the moment that you have to bring this up. Negotiate how long that you're going to be gone. Remember, rejection and abandonment is a universal trigger. And so if your close person in your life feels abandoned, it's going to trigger their emotional episode. So good to communicate about how long you need the break. Come back at the agreed upon time. If you're still too worked up, make an alternative time to discuss. So check in at least at the agreed upon time, and you can communicate to your loved one, hey, I need a little bit more time. But really important, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day who was talking about his ex-fiance and the fact that they broke up because they would have a conflict, and her strategy really was to go off and check into the Motel 6 and turn off her cell phone. And all of his rejection and abandonment stuff got triggered, and they just could not, it was an impasse that they just couldn't get past. Somehow they couldn't like figure out how to work through, you know, their styles. Because in conflict, his style was to kind of cling on to her ankles and her style was to run for the hills. So it didn't really lead to constructive emotional episodes, as you can imagine. And then during the wise break, don't drink, drive, or use drugs. Don't ruminate on how you're right and what you're going to say when you come back from the break. Easier said than done. Practice what you've learned to increase your relaxation and your awareness. So these are some of the guidelines for how to deal with wise breaks that you're taking in close relationships. Okay, anybody have anything to add to this if you're a practitioner of wise breaks? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Emails can be so dangerous. Even with emoticons embedded, emails can be so easily misunderstood. Yeah, great strategy. So yeah, communication about difficult stuff, I think always way better done in person because then you can get all of the other emotional signals. You don't read between the lines. Because remember, if you're in the middle of a refractory period and you get an email, even apologizing, you're just going to see it through the lens of that emotion that you're experiencing. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. It actually comes from biology. So when a neuron fires, there's a certain period of time before it'll be susceptible to a new impulse. Like a neuron will fire, and then there's a refractory period where it's kind of recovering, and then it'll be sort of receptive to new stimulus. So that it's borrowed from biology, actually. So it's sort of the same thing. Within that refractory period, no new stimulus is going to have an effect, just like no new stimulus of that neuron is going to have an effect until it's recovered. So it's sort of biological language. In fact, after teaching at the prison on Tuesday, I realized I want to talk to Eve Ekman, she's coming to Vajrapani this week, about simplifying some of the language, creating a simplified, because a lot of this is affect program. What the hell does that mean, right? Unless you're a psychologist, some of this, even emotional alert database, so creating a much more sort of user-friendly version with simplified non-psychological language. To somebody like Paul Ekman, they're like, yeah, no, this totally makes sense. And we're all, what? What's that? Oh, completely simple. But I realized, like I said, in the prison Tuesday, the inmates did not know what the word contempt meant. I mean, they certainly experienced the emotion, but they just weren't even familiar. And so you get into something like affect program. So I'm going to kind of work on that a little bit. In refractory period, I think we can simplify. So hopefully. Oh, does it mean that too? Refractory. Okay. Yeah, I don't know about that sense of the word. Yeah, maybe.
Which I thought it meant that your emotions were too
disobedient. And yeah, maybe. Maybe. Yeah. Refractory. Yes.
As an adjective, it is stubborn or unmanageable.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. So stubborn. Yeah, so the teenage boys. Yeah. Sorry, Daniel. Refractory, good. All right. So we've looked at that. So how to work with hot triggers, right? So these are some of the ones that almost always are provoking maybe destructive emotional episodes. One of the things that's really great is keeping a log of regrettable emotional episodes, the trigger, the behavior, what was regrettable. This is a way we can really get the information about the patterns. Sometimes it's too hard. Now you've done the emotional episode timeline, but doing it over and over and over again, keeping a log of it, really analyzing it. What was it in common? Is there an underlying story pattern? Narrative around that. This is where we can really get the information, especially about, these ones that definitely lead to these regrettable emotional episodes. So this can be a great strategy kind of moving forward, keeping a log. And then through this, we can recognize in advance situations likely to lead to triggers and avoid or prepare for them. One of the things that we do in Buddhist practice, we avoid while we're gaining strength and strategy and rehabituating. It's not about just sort of avoidance and denial about what's going on, but if you know for sure that that event is going to lead to a regrettable episode, much better to avoid in the short term while you're trying to train your mind to a different pathway of a mindful response rather than an automatic reaction. I've told this story. I think Anita's heard the story. Probably Marcella's heard this story. But it's so perfect. It's about American Thanksgiving, one of the most regrettable holidays in existence. And so this one student of mine, many years ago at Land of Medicine Buddha, and we were working, this is even before like cultivating emotional balance world, but we were just working with ways of responding with emotions. And he was talking to me about the upcoming holiday of Thanksgiving. And he was saying, oh, it's always the same thing. And my older sister says those patronizing things to me. And then I get really upset and yell at her. And then mom cries and the whole holiday is spoiled. And so we're kind of working around some strategies. And he comes in the week after Thanksgiving to class and he's like, I did it. I did it. It was awesome. And I was like, what happened? And he says, well, sure enough, over the cranberry sauce, you know, course, my sister said that thing. And he goes, and I felt it. Like, because we're working on awareness of emotional, you know, physically. And he felt the thing starting here and starting to rise up. But before it got to his throat and came out of his mouth, he said, I stood up, I walked out of the house, got my car, and drove home. And he's like, it was totally weird. He goes, like, they're calling me on my cell phone. Like, what the hell was that? But he goes, it was so much better than yelling at my sister, making my mother cry. He was like, and I said, that's awesome. I said, that's fabulous. First line of defense is, hey, if you know, I mean, he felt it. There was no way it wasn't going to come out. He just, right when it started coming up. And then with training, he got to the point where he could be non-reactive to even the provocative statements of his patronizing older sister who had always held it over his head his whole life, blah, 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 storyline, you know. So then in the meantime, working with the storyline to kind of reconfigure his response to that. But in the meantime, this can be really great, like recognizing and identifying which things are going to be super triggering for us. And it's fine to just avoid them in the short term or prepare for them. We can rehearse alternative behavior. And a great position to do that is with your rear end in direct contact with the meditation cushion. That's actually what meditation is all about. In fact, the word for meditation in Tibetan comes from a root that means habituation. And that's what it is. Take those episodes onto the meditation cushion, like we just did with rain, right? Take those episodes and retrain yourself for an alternative way of responding rather than reacting. And then when you're in that situation, then you've got a new knee-jerk response rather than a reaction. So this is really, really helpful. And this is a big part. I had an inmate talking about this guy who's been my student in prison. I've been teaching in prisons 10 years now, and he's been my student since like my very first class. And I think he's the most kind of one of the most keen students either in or outside of prison. I mean, he takes everything to heart. He used to be the ringleader of the Aryan Brotherhood, this white supremacist gang, like before he got into Buddhism. Now he's taken it on himself to protect the transgender inmates of color in his prison. Big shift. At great risk to life and limb for himself. So he said once in the prison, and he's taken on these compassion practices. There's a text in Buddhism that we call the 7-point thought transformation. Some of you I know are familiar with that text, and he's completely taken it to heart. So he's rehearsed so much. So he would say there would be these altercations in the exercise yard, and he'd be like, I got angry, but then I went and calmed down and like whatever. But he did that so much that he wrote me a letter about one time. He was out in the exercise yard and some guy came at him with a sharpened God knows what, you know, threatening his life. And he wrote me and he was kind of astonished. He actually said, wow, it was amazing. He goes, all I felt was compassion. I didn't feel any anger at all. And it kind of blew his mind. He was like, it was the first time. He said, in the past, I would feel anger, but I didn't react, You know, I would, and then I would go work on trying to feel compassion for the person later. But all of that practice totally paid off. I mean, it was one of the most moving letters. I kept it and read it out loud to my classes for like years because it was just incredible. He was like, seriously, honestly, I can totally honestly say the only feeling that came up when that angry guy with the shank was in my face was compassion. I was just like, right on, right on. That's practice. That's practice. But that's what this step is rehearsing, because of all of his practice, then an alternative behavior just came up instead of that other, you know, response. Reminding ourselves to reappraise the trigger. And this comes from that trigger may not mean what it did when we were 4 years old, right? We may not need to anymore react and respond in the same way. So kind of reappraising, especially those really learned triggers. Disabling the trigger by removing cognitive projections that distort our view. So this is part of the investigation piece of RAIN, is really looking at how am I distorting the whole thing? You know, is there some kind of projection that's distorting? And that's a way of disabling the trigger. In close relationships, once we know what our hot triggers are, we can communicate the need for a wise break. So here's some of the ways of working with our hot triggers. And then just one more page, moderating emotional behaviors, developing emotionfulness, attentively considering our emotional feelings. So this is part of just the recognizing of what's going on emotionally and understanding what some of the, both the physiological, you know, sensations, and just becoming very aware of what our emotional experience, becoming more aware of what triggers our emotions and identifying and weakening our own hot triggers, learning about the bodily sensations that distinguish each emotion and alert us to our emotional state. Develop impulse awareness. So when we have an impulse to act in a way that could be destructive, checking, you know, at the time where we actually feel the impulse, checking ourselves then, and maybe then going to the more mindful response pathway. Becoming more observant of the emotional feelings of others. Remember, I keep saying we can use all of this information and apply them to other people's emotional experience as well. Try broaden our understanding of the other person's situation. For example, is a refractory period distorting their perception? And then finally, even if we can't reappraise, even if we still feel our feelings are justified, we can choose to interrupt our actions, control our face and voice, and resist the impulses to act. So here's some of the ways that we can work. We can work to moderate at least the emotional behaviors. Okay? So any questions about, yeah, Joaquin.
With my children is the tone of voice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it triggers a lot of stuff that I don't mean. It's just
right,
and
right.
I told my psychologist that this is where I can change. And she said, yes, you can.
Yeah.
So over working one time, I said, well, yeah, I can change.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So lowering my voice to my children, it make a lot of difference.
Yeah.
You know, so
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I mean, I feel more empathy. I feel more calm.
Yeah.
And sometimes she's just look at me and it's, oh wow. So, and I know that the tone of voice makes a world. I mean,
absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It does.
You know, and a lot more research is being done now on the vocal expressions of emotions, which, you know, the researchers have really always said was definitely, there was correlates. And they're doing research of just playing short little sound bites of people's tone of voice to see if the research subjects can identify. There's some other research that I just love this one. There's a researcher at the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley, and his name is Dr. Keltner, and he's doing a lot of research on communicating emotions by touch. And he did this crazy experiment where he had two people sitting. They couldn't see each other at all. There was a barrier, but they could have their arms and hands going through the barrier. So he had one person being the recipient and one person being kind of the person giving the different touches, just through touch, to try and communicate 11 different emotions, including compassion, anger, 11 different emotions. And he said almost everybody could get all 11 just from touch. And then he said I saw a YouTube video of him giving a talk about this research, and he said, I have to say that there were gender differences. He said, when a woman was trying to communicate anger to a man, he had no idea what she was trying to communicate. And when a man was trying through touch to communicate compassion to a woman, she had no clue what he was talking about. He said, that was like across the board. Is that crazy or what? But for 11 different emotions, just touch on the forearm. So, wow, it's deep, you know, and body language is a whole other area of research that they're doing too. You know, like I said, that Paul Ekman just did the facial expressions, but the voice, the other body language, the touch, so much that we're communicating non-verbally to the people around us, you know, especially that we're close to and that we have relationships with. So it's really a fascinating area, this whole area of like emotions research, just fledgling and just completely fascinating stuff. Yeah. Any other? Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something to the loud voice. Because I had the experience of, I'm in the second floor and somebody or two people are in the ground floor.
Yeah. Yeah.
And both of them have a very strong and loud voice.
Yeah.
And each time I was upstairs and couldn't really identify the words, it was just loud voices, and I could never figure out, are they actually discussing or are they already fighting?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's very, very cultural also. I remember one time, this is when I was in my mid-20s, and I was visiting a friend who lived in New Jersey, in this Italian-American neighborhood in New Jersey. And three of us went for a walk at night around dinner time through this neighborhood. There was the loudest shouting coming out of every single house. And I'm like freaking out a little bit, just going, oh my God. And my friend who lived in that neighborhood goes, no, it's just these Italian families having dinner. You know, they're just like yelling at each other at the top of my lungs. And I'm coming from my like WASP background of like, oh my God, it's like everybody's fighting. You know, we're going to hear gunshots any minute. They're like, no, it's a nice family dinner in the Italian neighborhood, you know. So huge cultural differences about like volume, tones of voice, things like that. Like what's accepted and okay and not triggering in one culture. I mean, you know, don't even get me started about cultural differences and like times that I've been in situations completely misreading what's going on because of something like tone of voice and reading a lot of threat into it. Yeah, Daniel. Yeah. So volume, very, very cultural. Yeah.
I saw something that was like they had an actor or actress, and then the panel was to interview them. And what the panel didn't know was that they gave emotion to the activist, and they were supposed to respond with that emotion. And what ended up happening as the person questioned them, you know, there was a happy one, there was a sad one, there was a kind of irate one. The person questioning kind of picked up the emotion, and their questions kind of took the tone.
Ah, right, right, right. Yeah, 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 yeah.
It's really interesting.
Motions are extremely contagious.
You know, if you have some control over the flashpoints, that you possibly can defeat.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, yeah.
The people that were questioning had no idea what was happening. Each one of them fell into line with whatever emotion the actor was portraying as they answered the question.
Interesting, yeah, yeah, yeah. Emotions are contagious, and we can use that because you can use a calm voice to diffuse a situation where people are feeling maybe strong anger. I mean, I found that you just use a very calm voice, you know, modulate. It's sort of like even with an angry animal, like a dog or something, you just talk to them in a certain way and it really helps. So we can use it to our advantage too, to kind of modulate emotional responses. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, right. Any other comments or questions? Yeah, Marcella.
About the voice break.
Yeah.
Sure is. Yeah, where the therapies are giving us the tool that when we feel the emotion that is coming from here, and before it comes out, we say, you know what, I need a break.
Yeah.
We go to the second floor and we take a few minutes upstairs.
Yeah.
And then when we come down, you know, we're more okay.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And too, because if it happened to him, I start feeling the same thing,
sure,
and then give me the break for me too, and then, you know, everything changed.
Right,
we're trying
right.
to change to modify the behavior.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's a pattern, because always I start, and then we start raising our voice, and we turn more upset, you know. But
yeah.
It's working. That.
And thinking, like, about the fact that you know you're in the refractory period, the emotions are already triggered. Anything that's going to happen, you know, is going to just add to that emotion that you're feeling. So using that kind of understanding as a way to kind of give yourself permission, like it's not running away. It's actually, that's why we call it a wise break. Mm-hmm. You know, because sometimes we kind of think, no, I don't want to be in denial. I don't want to avoid. I want to deal with it. Well, yeah, deal with it when it's the appropriate time. So I think knowing this information about the refractory period can also give us permission that when it's appropriate to do something like that, otherwise things will just escalate. Daniel, come over here closer because the air conditioning's, oh no, now it's off. Now I can hear you. Now you can go back. No, come with us. Come hang out with us. You could. But we've only got a couple more minutes, so it's going to be limited.
What about my mom said that she's actually sometimes, she actually sometimes did that to herself, so, like, she actually, like, makes herself go to her room sometimes.
Yeah.
For 5 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. 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 And that's appropriate, right? So when you just feel something and you feel like, okay, it's going to be regrettable, time for a break. I think that's a wise thing. Yeah, very good.
I got his approval. So okay.
Good, good. I'm so glad. Yes.
I realized something in regards to Dr. Keltner's research. About
yeah. Right.
So maybe just women and men have different ways of
express. Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, they probably could tell. They could see the arm, so they could tell if
so
probably.
The recipient has to identify, so the recipient couldn't see the arm, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, because that was what was going through the barrier, was the arm. I don't know. I don't think they were, like, blindfolded. I don't remember that part of it.
I didn't see the experiment, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, and I don't know if they could see the arm, so if there's the signal of, like, knowing the, you know, being able to kind of figure out the gender of the person.
The person who's trying to identify the emotion is the person with the arm, sticking the arm out.
Oh, I see what you mean. I see what you're saying. Right, right, right. So I see what you're saying.
So
that's right.
They don't know who's
on the other side. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Because it sounds like from what he said, when men were communicating anger to men, they got it. But it was just when women were trying to communicate anger to men, the men didn't get it. Yeah, I can't remember.
Did women communicate the anger to other women?
It seems like, because he was just talking about those differences, so it seems like with other pairings, it worked. Because those are the only things. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I haven't read, like, the whole paper. I just saw this, like, 10-minute kind of YouTube video where he's talking about his research, but I thought it was so interesting that that nuance of emotion could be, of these, like, 11 different emotions could be communicated just through touch on the forearm. I was just like, I never would have guessed that. Like, that was kind of mind-blowing to me. Yeah. Wow. Well. That was a lot, wasn't it? So we're at the end of our day. There's a lot more, as you can imagine. Let's see, 42 minus 6 is 36 more hours worth of emotional work. But I mostly, like I said, I pick and choose a little bit. But for me, the emotional episode timeline and the way of working with that has been so helpful in my own life and my own practice that I really wanted us to get the experience of that. And also really the piece that emotions are functional. We evolve these things. They're not our enemy, because it's really easy to go to that place too a little bit of like, oh, if I could only just wipe out my emotions, then I would be happy. But remember, you know, what I'd love to have you take away is just sort of the idea of emotions having a function, that it's about constructive and destructive emotional episodes, not about positive and negative emotions. Because as we've seen, some of the ones that aren't so much fun to feel, like sadness, definitely have, you know, a function for us, help us to communicate. We need the whole repertoire. Life is not going to be a Pepsi commercial, and it would be incredibly boring, and we wouldn't have, you know, a rich emotional life. So that's sort of the beginning. We will, I will give the PDF to Urs so he can kind of distribute that to all of you so that you'll have all of that data. And I'm sorry I didn't say that at the beginning. I sort of thought I'd done that, but that was for, I've been teaching too much lately and I'm getting mixed up about who did I give the PDF of which slideshow. But you will have that so that you'll have some of that information and just kind of continue exploring. What I'll try and do when I send the PDF to is a suggested reading list that we have. So you can read, you know, a lot of really good stuff from Paul Ekman's research. There's a couple of books of his dialogues with His Holiness the Dalai Lama about emotions, which are also really fascinating, and then some of Alan Wallace's work, and then some other related things. So we've got a kind of suggested reading list, so I'll send that along too. So let's just take a minute to reflect. What we usually do at the end of teachings is dedicate our merit, and I want to also acknowledge, I was told that one person who is meant to come today, Cynthia, who's one of the board members here, actually had a car accident on her way here, and her car was totaled. She's got a concussion, a small concussion, and a little bit of injury, neck and shoulder, not so bad, but she would have really wanted to be with us today. So if we can send a little bit of our positive energy out to Cynthia. So let's just take a minute to reflect on all of the learning from today, all the positive energy, and just give yourself, rejoice for a minute, give yourself credit for all of the hard work. It's not so easy really delving into our emotions. There was a lot of discussion in your small groups, a lot of sharing. Very brave to do this work, to look into emotions, and just with the motivation to have a much more constructive emotional life, to bring benefit both to ourselves and to all living beings. So take a moment just to dedicate that positive energy, and also send some healing energy to Cynthia, who would have been with us today. Thank you all for your energy and attention, and thank you to the OCBC posse, to Margaret and Urs, and yeah, and Tris and Emily. Yeah, such hard work, and the centers run completely by volunteers, and they just put on one awesome program after another. So thank you all for your incredibly hard work. It's awesome. Thank you.